Executive Director of the National Film Preservation Foundation. I'm the designated square from an institution that's internationally recognized, you know, to add a patina of sophistication and historical significance to the smut and reactionary stuff you're about to see. We're not going to say much about Stephen because we programmed this to kind of speak for him and Oddball and his different activities. I just want to thank Dan and Orphans for reaching out to a group of us to put together this program, including myself, Regina Longo, Genevieve Havemeyer-King, Skip Alzheimer, Andrew Lampert, and Greg Pierce, and also Antonella Bonfanti, who couldn't be here but was very helpful. This program, as I need to explain to you, is in three sections. There's going to be a section I introduce, and then Regina is going to come up and give you something, and then the miscreants, Skip, Andy, Greg, are going to come up. They've named themselves the subpars for these sort of these things. It should be good. But I also want to recognize that in the audience, Valerie Parr is here, Stephen's sister, and I really want to thank her for coming. It's really great to have her. And some old friends from high school from Stephen, including this one guy that I met in San Francisco. There was a tribute to Stephen at the Roxy Theater on 16th Street, and you know, we kind of got the call to come in. Greg and Skip came to my house and they said, well, we're gonna go over to the archive and try to set this up. And we went over there and there's this guy, you know, with the goatee and he's doing this. He's behind a keyboard and he's like, oh, you guys. He's like, I'm gonna run something by you. And it's like, who's this guy? Turns out he knew Stephen in high school. They were best buddies. Long history, you'll hear from him, but it's the kind of situation where you walk into a room, it's like, who the fuck is this guy? And then 90 seconds later, it's like, this guy fucks. So that gentleman is John Kuhn. You'll hear from him later. Just to talk about the three films we're about to see right now, which I think are meant to represent like Oddball cinema and what Stephen would show, and also the San Francisco Media Archive, which is a nonprofit that Stephen began and got grants from the National Film Preservation Foundation for. The first film is, when we were asked to do this, what film is iconic in the Stephen Parr legacy, particularly in relation to Orphans? And I remember sitting in South Carolina and, you know, there was a night and I said, Stephen, are you showing anything? And he did the Stephen Parr smirk. Oh, I'm showing something. So the first film we're going to see is from 1944. It's by the U.S. Navy. It's called Giving an Enema. Now, luckily, I reached out to the folks at Oddball, and Adam Zajenski kindly located Stephen's 8-minute trimmed version, so it's a little shorter, because even Stephen knew that like a little butt play could go on too long. So that's showing first in a digital file. And then there's gonna be Blackie the Wonder Horse, which is the first grant that Stephen got from the National Film Preservation Foundation. It's gonna be shown in 16 millimeter. This is an answer print that I don't think has been screened, but they sent it out to us for this occasion. The great thing about Stephen was he would relocate films, so he'd always be like, Jeff, I'm gonna show this at the Nautical Society. And I'm like, I don't know what the fuck the San Francisco Nautical Society is. He's like, they're gonna show Blackie the Wonder Horse. I'm like, great. But he was always activating the films in the community to places that would never think to show them. And then finally, a choice that was made by Genevieve, which I think is really indicative of Stephen's programming style at Oddball, and Genevieve worked with him there. It's called Candy Girl. It's from the 1970s. And you're just going to see it. It's 5 minutes. It's really interesting. But I went on to the Oddball website to see what did Stephen program with that. And it was part of a program called Strange Cinema, with an S, cinema. So, and it was a 79th program. And so here are just a few of the titles that were on the bill that day. Home Movie Hijinks with Front Yard Ben. creepy Christmas basket, effects of a frontal lobotomy on generalized tics, wild elephant roundup, San Francisco police bombing, Wexler allergy test films, blind children with pony, untitled Russian reel, and Colt 45 malt liquor. So I'll leave you with that. Enjoy the ride. Sit back. Relax your buns. The U.S. Navy is going to be given an enema.
Hey, I'm Skip Elsheimer of AV Geeks. I have one of the largest personal collections of 16mm film on the East Coast. I met Stephen Parr at the very first night of the very first Orphans Film Symposium in Columbia, South Carolina. We had emailed each other. We had this relationship. We were competitively friendly, involved in a little pissing contest as far as who had the most films, what films we had, and what we were going to show. This next film I'm going to show is called Living in a Reverse World, and he showed it at the Media Archaeology conference in Houston, Texas, and I was like, dude, I totally have to get that film. So I found it on eBay. So this is my copy. And what I like about this film is it purports to be a science film, but it's really just a bunch of people fucking with each other. So here we go.
It is not at all easy to explain why you should perceive the motion picture screen to be in front of you. Images, nothing but images, are given to us by the eye. No one can tell from an image where the thing is. If I look at you through a tube, this way, and then again, this way, the picture in my eye is the same. Nevertheless, this way, I see you in front of me, and this way on my right. How is this possible? Because I feel at once the different positions of my head and eyes in relation to the rest of my body. What we take to be seeing really depends on another sense, the body sense, or touch. In early childhood, it was hard to learn to coordinate seeing and touching. They cooperate with one another if one is not lightheaded. But a few drinks are all that is needed to break up the proper coordination of feeling and seeing. The simplest way to break up the cooperation of seeing and touching is a mirror. Looking into a mirror, one sees in front what is really behind, and therefore one reaches in the wrong direction. But the sensation of touch produces a kind of reversal of seeing. Here is a wet sponge slapped on his back. Now he feels as if he had eyes in the back of his head. It is similar when you feel things in this way. In this case, the fingers, the sense organs, are in front of you. But nevertheless, the touched object is immediately perceived as behind. Now for the second experiment. The eyes perceive right and left with the help of the body sense. A mirror prism like this makes a world in which right and left are reversed. Moreover, everything tilts when you turn your head. But with other things, one notices the reversal from side to side at once. For example, with printing. Are you prepared to wear these right-left reversing spectacles for several weeks without interruption? From now on, never go without this device. It looks so without the spectacles. But with the spectacles, the cactus appears to be on the other side. Ouch! Have a glass of water. Ah, now he tries another technique. He controls the movement of his hand with his eyes. This is probably the solution. Aha, he knows how to drink. For this, the spectacles do not give him any trouble. But he must see the table on the wrong side. No matter. Next, this problem. Draw a line to number 2 and then to number 3. Above and below is easy, as you would expect. But when it comes to right and left, everything is badly mixed up. In a parallel experiment, a hen can be made to wear the spectacles. She cannot catch the pictures of things. They evade her every time she moves her head. Here is the subject in his everyday activity. He does not give up. From the very beginning, he tries to practice. One has to learn to see the hand where one feels. physical body as represented by a shadow image. Now he begins to get for the ball. Exercises like these are the road to success. After 14 days, he can manage street traffic. What has the hen learned in the same interval? Without practicing enough, she still chases the elusive images. The man, however, has mastered the work. The landscape is now stable when he moves his head, but is still reversed. However, this can be remedied. If a steep slope has to be climbed, he must pay attention to the hands and feet. The way it looks and the way it feels then cease to be contradictory. Letters and words still remain unfamiliar. After 2 months, however, the end is accomplished. Observe that he now can see things perfectly correctly. Now let us discover how things look to this man when the spectacles are removed. Which of the two figures corresponds to the arm movement? The triangle. With the naked eye, he now sees things reversed. But this apparent reversal does not last long. Now we come to the third possibility of reversing the work, up and down. Here it is fundamentally different. These three men, despite the positions of their heads, all see things right side up. Right side up is determined by the gravity of the earth, not the position of the body. But this changes if a mirror device is worn, which reverses the direction of up and down. Now, the sitting man sees everything upside down, and the man who was hanging head down sees everything right side up. What will a man do if he has to fence in this situation? The results of all these tests are recorded. After 5 days of practice, he reacts correctly almost 100% of the time. But even so, he still perceives his fencing partner as upside down. Can this also be remedied? Certainly. Throughout the whole body, the pull of gravity operates. All that is necessary is to emphasize it. So, yes, you held your hands upward. What does this playing card look like? Oh, I see both of the heads right side up. The old way of seeing and the new way are still in conflict. Practice in which one feels not only touch but also the force of gravity are especially helpful in bringing about upright perception. Now, we make a test to find out whether he sees correct. Please read.
Number one is an M and two is a W.
Oh, think of gravity.
Oh, no. One's a W and two's an M.
After another week, when correct proceeding has been achieved, he is ready for the end of the experiment. The mirror is secretly removed from the device. The eyes are free. And now for the big test. This is a room which is really upside down, including the furnishings. He had learned to see it right side up. He has learned to live in a topsy-turvy world. Only the force of gravity has shown him how to do so. But it took time. Now the experiment is over. except for a few bruises, there are no serious after effects. Do you agree now that it is not at all self-evident that you should see the motion picture screen to be in front of you?
Hello. Hi, my name is Greg Pierce. I am from the Oregon Archive in Pittsburgh and the Andy Warhol Museum in the same city. Met Steven at Orphans 3. Thank you, Dan. I think that was 2003. And did my first show with him at the show that Skip mentioned at the Aurora Picture Show in Houston. We actually were on the same bill that night. So I am going to introduce a little clip that I actually bought for the museum years ago, probably over a decade, maybe 15 years ago. It's a clip from a Providence, a local Providence news station. They went and interviewed Warhol when he was there with the Velvets doing the EPI at the Providence gig. It's probably the day of March 31st, 1967. Steven had titled this, but I'm not going to give you the title because it actually spoils the punchline of the piece if you haven't seen it. So about 3 minutes. It's good. It's funny. So enjoy.
Andy Warhol is one of the nation's foremost pop artists and designers. One of his most notable accomplishments to date is a painting of a soup can. Tonight and tomorrow, Mr. Warhol and his party are staging an exhibition at the invitation of the Rhode Island School of Design Students Association. Mr. Warhol, your appearance in Providence has been billed as a happening. Will you tell us what a happening is?
I never really knew what a happening was because we've never done one. This is just a show. And it's with the Velvet Underground and dancers and movies. And nothing really happens.
The show is billed as an exploding plastic inevitable. What significance does this have?
Well, everybody's made out of plastic, that's why.
Mr. Warhol, are you trying to communicate any message?
It's so pretty down here. I'm not sure.
Well, whatever you're trying to do, you think you're reaching anybody?
No. We're not really reaching anybody. But it really looks like stars down here. Do you see anything? Look up. It's fantastic. Can you see the stars?
Hi, I'm Andrew Lampert. When did I first meet Steven? Oh, 2002, I think. Mia, in the basement of the hotel, there was a presentation that was supposed to be about video art and the legacy and Nam June Paik and things like that, which attracted me. When I got downstairs, I found a yappy little man who was in the midst of technical chaos, which was the Steven Parr I came to know and love for many years. And I often found him in that situation, as I think many of us did. And it was on that day where we really bonded, and he immediately invited me to come visit. And we had lots of great moments over the years. A few things that I really remember vis-a-vis Orphans is particularly a lot of stuff happened in the Carolina editions, but the first one in New York, Stephen had a little device that you could use to turn off TVs in public spaces. It's a remote control, so I remember walking around the city just turning off TVs and sports bars. and the absolute glee that it never failed to arouse in him. And then at the same time, I had downloaded on the brand new-ish iPhone an app that was called Annoy a Teen, which plays a very high-pitched sound that only teenagers and like many cats can hear. And you, yeah. And so we, during some of the slower presentations, annoyed some teens and evidently a few adults who could still have the hearing range. So, I mean, we all have very impotent Stephen Parr stories, but play on words. I'm here to introduce two clips. So Stephen, besides, of course, being this incredible character, this collector, this archivist, this showman, was in his earlier incarnation also and throughout a video artist. He studied at the University of Buffalo in the Media Study Department under Woody and Stan Avasolka with Tony Conrad, many other sort of legends of the field. And he was even within this sort of circus-like department his own ring. And John Kuhn, who we'll have up here in a minute, was a co-conspirator in some of these things. But Stephen had access to video technology then, you know, obviously very hard to get access to. And he used it however he could. There are lots of tapes, I have to assume, and lots of stories about things that were done and which cannot be presented ever again for various legal and technical reasons. But the two clips we're going to watch right now, one comes from Buffalo, one's from slightly later. The first is a 1976 reading by poet, author, musician, Fug, Ed Sanders, who is, it's just a little clip from a longer Port-a-Pack tape. Two of the things that Stephen was actually proud to have documented there was this Sanders reading, as well as the only documentation of an important John Cage performance about the weather. Both of which he later on transferred and digitized. So we'll be seeing the Sanders. And then what follows is actually something really amazing. It's from a space that he had prior to Oddball, Club Generic in San Francisco, which was his nightclub. All sorts of performance, all sorts of things happened there, including this probably the earliest documented video performance by Stephen of work by Christian Marclay. Christian Marclay, who you may know as a visual artist who also works with sound primarily through turntables. He had been studying in Boston, and he had a group called Bachelors Even, a Duchamp reference. And this is a performance done at Stephen's place in San Francisco. So when Stephen digitized it, he was able to connect him to give it to Marclay, who was astounded, who had no memory of this whatsoever. Of course, that's always how it goes, right? So even though the artist doesn't remember it, now we still have it. Sort of one of these great latent things that archivists do for those who make art and quickly move on. So we'll watch those two clips, and then we'll come back with a couple more things. Thank you.
Thank you. poor Sam, another human child, thinking with socialist hunger about a possible bomb job on my Sony voice-actuated sneak recorder built into a carved-out copy of the Bullingen Litany of Rob. Bizarrely dying, a book dealer slid toward the rasping quakes of the oxygen bottle with a stack of my books to sign. Another broke into tears of grief when I told the assembled mourners that I had burned 40 years of literary letters from the scribes of the decadent West. But there were others there, too, whom I loved. Others whose ancestors today roam the brief world looking for thrills. Yes, you. Mm-hmm. And now these many years later, my welcome tongue of persistence is going to nibble where the flesh goes crazy. I hear no throat and pink nose of gendering. Please rub these words on your lips for a poor dead poet who would have loved you.
So we're the subpars.
Yeah.
We're acting as tonight's evacuants. Thanks.
We're going to just show a clip of something that, just to set it up. So we all sort of come together at the Orphans 3, and then all of us go down that same year, possibly, to Houston, Texas, for this thing called the Archaeology. Media, whatever that is. From there, a bond was formed that resulted in a number of years of performances and screenings hosted at Anthology Film Archives, where I would invite each of these guys and Steven to come up and present works. Usually, it started off with, do whatever you want to do, and then we all started to challenge each other, myself showing things from Anthology's collection, and then not just challenge, compete with each other. And we got to a point where after maybe like 6 years of this, it was like, what can we do? What can we do? And an idea was sprung to try to show films that we all really deeply love, but you can't really justify it because they're so boring. Which, if you're an archivist, you know exactly what we're talking about. There's something very particular you like about it, but it doesn't really communicate. So the question then became, If you can't watch it on its own, what happens if you watch four boring films at the same time? So Fest was born something called That's Undertainment, which happened upstairs in Anthology in the Courthouse Theater. We split the screen into four projection quadrants. We each committed to building two 30-minute reels that would be projected simultaneously with obviously some sort of real change would happen in between. And we set out the goal for ourselves to just go for it, you know, because the question really was, will this be entertaining? Can the quadruple image overcome complete and total lack of content? And yeah, evidently it really can. But the one thing I'll say about this is that,
Stephen cheated. He played stuff that was very interesting. As he was known to do, he totally cheated. But and you can look at it when we project it. And I would ask in the projection booth if we can start showing it and then just bring the lights down, but not play any sound, so we can have people kind of. We want John to come up and talk about Stephen as we're watching this totally unentertaining material.
So yeah, if you want to just start it, please go ahead and you can dim the light however it works best technically for you.
The fourth subpar. John Kuhn, please.
And you'll know which one's interesting, and that's Stephen.
Entertaining yet boring, no content. That's what I thought of these guys when I met them a couple of months ago. You heard a story earlier about that was a complete lie when we were introduced. Back in January, I was sitting in Oddball doing a task that got dropped on my lap that day. I wasn't very happy. I was inside 6,000 square feet of Steve Parr's mind, and three guys walk in the door. I go, who the fuck are these clowns? Oh, I got to run something by you. That's the other side of the story. When Steve's memorial was happening, afterwards we had this little party, and people come up to me and they go, well, what can you say about Steve Parr? I said, got a minute? He was provincial and he was perverted. He was magnificent and he was annoying. He was clairvoyant and he was dim. I knew him for 50 years. And during that whole time, the world was a little brighter every day he was out there, because I knew he was doing what he was supposed to do and doing what he had to do. And he did it every day. He never shirked his duty. Particularly when he was in Buffalo and emerged as a character named Dr. Dada Descarto, who wore a Mylar hat and Mylar sunglasses. As orphans is the theme here, our first show there was called America's Orphan that I had written. It was based around a disfigured mannequin. I looked like a sartorial Charles Manson. And we got done. It came off. I said, now we got to do something. It was 11 o'clock at night. Parr goes, I know what we can do. All of a sudden, Steve appears as Dr. Dada Scardo, the Mylar top hat, the Mylar glasses, this little t-shirt. It's 25 degrees below zero outside. I take the mannequin like this, like it was a girlfriend, and Steve has a dog collar and a leash and somehow appeared with a pair of handcuffs. And he goes, you've got to lead me around. I went, okay. He takes us to this house of a poetry professor that's in this giant living room, a big Victorian. And Steve's behind me going, I am your media slave. I am your media slave. We walk into this place, it's like the professor with the, you know, the elbow patches and, you know, kids from Long Island. I'm going to read a poem about hitchhiking. It's called Hitchhiking. You know. One day I was hitchhiking, you know. Parr the whole time next to me going, I am your media slave. I am your media slave. And I've got the disfigured mannequin. At which point I'd signed up under a non-diplume. The professor goes, there's some people with some pretty weird trips here tonight, but we're just going to, you know, go on. Now I introduce our next reader, which was me. Put the mannequin up. I dedicate this poem to my girlfriend. Parr next to me the whole time going, I'm your media slave. I'm your media slave. I still don't know where he came up with the handcuffs on short notice. This was Dr. Dada Descarto. His work in Buffalo was very important. He did things that had never been done. And I got run out of Buffalo. I had been run out of New York. I'd been run out of Detroit. I moved to San Francisco. Steve decided I wasn't in enough trouble on my own, so he moved to San Francisco and opened an after-hours club 8 blocks from my house, which is where all this went on. That was a real scene. At the end of the day, I'm not part of the film world. I came from the music world. But Steve and I were always close and we're following the same muse. And Oddball Film was Steve Barr.
This really sucks, right? Why don't we relieve you and go to our final piece for this presentation?
I did want to interject that you can't have an Orphans without Stephen Parr, and I have put his form on a little sticker. If you haven't received a sticker, a What Would Stephen Do sticker, please find me or one of us and take the sticker and put it somewhere where you make important life decisions. And there's no guarantee that Stephen will guide you in the right direction. In fact, he might guide you in the absolute worst direction, but just because he thinks that would be funny.